Welcome to the Peak Work Performance Summit, where we talk about scientifically proven ideas that make us smarter, healthier, and more productive. My name is Ron Friedman, and my guest today is author David Rock. David is the director of the NeuroLeadership Institute, a global initiative bringing together neuroscientists and leadership experts to build a new science for leadership development. He's also the author of two business bestsellers, Quiet Leadership and Your Brain at Work, both excellent and highly useful reads. In the interview you're about to watch, David shares his tips for listening more attentively and offers useful statements that you can use to get others to open up. You'll also hear David explain why most people are terrible at delivering feedback and discover how you can do it better. Here's my discussion with David Rock. Enjoy. Now, before we start, David, let me ask you about the setting. You seem to be in a very relaxed place today. Tell us about where you are and what you're doing.
I'm actually on vacation out on Fire Island, and I have a ritual every summer. I have half-time August. I find with the amount going on, I can't kind of take a whole, you know, week or two off without it being incredibly stressful before and after. Uh-huh. But I can actually have a whole month where I work at a dramatically lower pace, maybe 2 or 3 days a week where I do calls, and 4 or 5 days a week where I'm really, you know, being with the family and being healthy, et cetera. So yeah, I'm having half-time August, and I find I can actually have a whole month of very long weekends. And it's really sustaining.
It's interesting because, you know, I think for a lot of us, we tend to assume that we're either in work mode or we're in vacation mode, but you actually find that blending the two is helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have explicit days off where I definitely don't do any work because it can creep in. But I just find that, you know, a 4 day long weekend is actually very refreshing if you do completely switch off. And if you can do one of those back to back, you know, 3 or 4 times, actually you just think completely different quality of thoughts. Mm-hmm. And what I find over August is I'm kind of doing different level of reflection, different quality of thinking across the whole month. I make really different decisions and notice different patterns and work on different things than I might do in the year. I can literally think bigger thoughts because I've got more space.
That's interesting. You know, on the topic of getting people to think better thoughts, you know, in your book, Quiet Leadership, which I think is fantastic, you provide a series of tips on how to both lead more effectively and how to collaborate more effectively with others. And one of the things that you say when it comes to leadership is that a good leader lets others do all of the thinking. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think I don't want people to think that this is over-rotating too far. You know, leaders still need to do some of the thinking. Leaders need to kind of develop strategy and decide what good performance looks like and, you know, a number of things. But, you know, when they're interacting with their team and they're having conversations, it's incredibly helpful to help actually develop other people's thinking versus just say, look, you know, here's what I need you to do, X, Y, Z. And it's incredibly helpful. I mean, it's a completely different biological phenomena to say to someone, you know, call these three customers, tell them this exactly, versus saying, you know, what do you think we should do next with these three customers and having a dialogue. It's a completely different biological phenomena. And it turns out that the latter actually grows people, but also often helps generate much better ideas as well.
So what happens biologically that's different?
Well, I mean, if you imagine, and no one's done this study yet, but if you imagine, you know, two people in a scanner that's reading, reading, you know, where oxygen's flowing and different regions. You can imagine a leader and an employee in a scanner, and you know, they're trying to work out what to do with a customer. If the leader is telling, then the leader has thought through the problem and has come up with a solution and just, you know, knows what needs to happen. And the employee doesn't have the space to actually think through the problem. They're just being told, you know, do X, Y, Z. And so they've got to just act. They've got to just follow something that they haven't necessarily thought through. They haven't necessarily understood. Now, when we just follow actions that we don't have a why, we're significantly less clear. We make more mistakes. We don't know what to do when we hit a roadblock. You know, we're not sure of the intent. We're just not as committed or as effective mm-hmm. as if we actually understand why we're doing something. So that's, you know, that's one factor. So the employee just, you know, hasn't had the chance to actually understand the why. Another reason is that and I say this in my book, you know, ideas are like children. There are none so wonderful as your own. You know, it's the manager's idea that's making the manager look good. It's raising the manager's status, right? Whereas if the employee feels like it's their idea, it actually raises their status. And status is a huge variable for driving our performance across the board. And we're all driven to actually maximize our own status. And one of the ways we do that is we don't want to raise other people's necessarily. So we don't necessarily want to help other people's ideas look good. It makes their status kind of go up. So we have this, you know, this automatic kind of argument almost that's usually very unconscious. When someone tells us what to do, we just naturally want to argue and basically improve the idea. And it's a healthy thing in a lot of contexts, right? But in terms of, you know, getting things done, it kind of gets in the way. It becomes really inefficient. You know, the manager has a great idea, tells the employee what to do, and the employee, just because it wasn't their idea, wants to argue and improve it. It might be a perfectly good idea. It's kind of this knee-jerk reaction that happens around status. And it literally just kills time. It creates noise that actually inhibits signal. And then a third reason is you know, the manager actually thinks through the problem, makes a set of connections. And in that moment where he makes a new connection, it's like completing a line on Sudoku. It's actually a little buzz. It's a nice little dopamine high from solving a problem. And so the manager is excited about the solution. They've actually got this nice burst of dopamine and adrenaline and excitement. And all this shows up as commitment and engagement, right, to the solution. The employee, on the other hand, hasn't had any of that, right? They haven't had the opportunity to go, oh, I've got it, and have this little aha phenomena occur in their brain that would actually motivate and engage them to go forward. So there's actually an enormous difference on many, many levels between, you know, do this and, you know, what do you think we should do? Or what do you think between these two options, even? If you don't think the employee's got the, you know, going to have a good idea, what do you think between these two options even will help? So there's lots of research behind that, but those are the three big buckets.
So we just talked about how you're on vacation, you're having all of these great ideas that are coming to you. When you get back to the office, how are you going to apply some of the insights you've just given me about how important it is to involve your team members in the decision making? So in other words, are you going to go in and say, I had these three ideas that I think are really terrific, let's talk about implementing them? I'm guessing you're not going to say that. You're not going to be quite as direct. What are you going to say?
Well, it depends. I mean, a lot of the stuff I have when I'm on vacation, and then I'll answer your question, is much kind of, it's not tactical. It's not, oh, we should do this week. I mean, you sort of get a almost like an aftershock of those when you first go on break, you know, stuff that you'd forgotten to handle. And then they go away and you think much bigger thoughts that are more about like the strategy for the next 5 years, or things I hadn't thought about, you know, our overall plan. So it's also I'm writing some things. So it's more kind of personal stuff. But yeah, for sure, if I'm going back to the office with kind of a, you know, big burning platform, I'm going to say to people, you know, I've got a great idea, or I think it might be a good idea, but I could be wrong. And I want to throw it around with you guys and look at it from all angles and see what comes up. And so I won't kind of tell them, hey, we have to do this. I'll say, let's brainstorm together. And this leaves people space to feel like they've got some ownership. They've got some status in it. They've also got some autonomy in the process. They're choosing, right, to lean into this idea. And status and autonomy are two, you know, really important drivers of behavior. So, yeah, so I'd go back and say, let's take it apart and see if it makes sense to do or not. And sometimes, to be honest, it doesn't. And it seemed like a good idea to me, but there's stuff that I don't know that these guys do that tells me maybe we should wait 6 months.
Can you give us two or three key statements that any leader should have in their conversational repertoire when it comes to helping others clarify their thinking?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a few. I mean, just the statement or question, you know, what's at the heart of why you say that? Or what's really driving you to say that? You know, what's your ultimate goal here? I think it's really helpful. You know, we sort of deal with a lot of noise and forget to ask, like, what's your real motivation here? What's your intention? And we're always driven by intentions. You know, and sometimes the intention might be to, you know, raise revenue. Another time it might be to trounce the competition. It might be to look good in front of their peers, or, you know, who knows what, or just to, you know, argue because for the sake of arguing, you know, but, you know, get to the bottom of, you know, what's really driving your, you know, what's really driving your statement here is one. Another one, you know, when you're debriefing with someone, it's so tempting, you know, if you're debriefing with someone on a, say, project that hasn't gone well, or, a, you know, pitch that hasn't gone well or something, it's so tempting. We've all been taught to, you know, do a post-mortem, what works, what didn't work, all this stuff. But what happens is when you get to the stuff that what didn't work, you just, you basically have an argument. You're trying to convince the person that they could have done better. They're trying to convince you that it was totally not their fault. And, you know, they're protecting their status. And we protect our status very, very thoroughly. It's like, and that's because, you know, a drop in status literally can make us die younger. A raise in status literally can make us live longer. So, you know, we really do protect our status, and for good reason. So I'd say rather than, you know, what went well, what didn't, it's more like, you know, a whole bunch of stuff happened. What, you know, what ideas do you already have for doing this better next time? You know, you're a smart person. I bet you're already thinking about, you know, innovations the next time we do this. What are some of those? And then people either have them and they'll tell you, or they'll dig deep for some right then. So instead of them saying, oh, no, I did fine, it wasn't my fault, they'll actually dig deep for things that they might be able to do better. So it's a really different approach. So, you know, what ideas do you already have for doing this better next time? I bet you've got some. It just reduces a lot of the noise, increases the signal on, you know, what's really relevant. So those are two good ones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So not assuming that we understand the intention, really clarifying that, and then also giving people the benefit of the doubt for having good ideas.
Yeah.
You know, along the same lines, you talk about how a good leader listens for potential. How do I implement that on a practical basis? How do I listen for potential?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's, you know, we're so tempted to notice the gaps and the mistakes people make. And the reason for that is biological. We actually are driven to notice potential dangers much more than potential threats. We're driven to see variance versus similarity much more easily. It just keeps us alive. And, you know, you put someone in the scanner and show them a happy face, their brain lights up a little bit, maybe this much. Show them an angry face, it lights up like way more. There's a lot more activity going on across more regions. So, you know, really jumps out, the negative really jumps out. And what I would say is really important is to be consciously thinking about how people are growing and developing, how, you know, what people are passionate about, and, you know, try to find those things people are really interested naturally in doing and are actually, you know, good at and getting better at. And if you can find those things and, you know, structure a role around that, you know, everyone's happier, everyone's more productive. And so, you know, listening for potential is really, you know, finding where someone's going or where they're trying to go, and developing them. And it's hard, you know, for managers, growing people is one of the things they're worst at. Growing talent is one of the capacities they're, you know, literally worst at. So it can be a challenge.
Is there something that you kind of keep in the back of your mind as you're engaging with one of your team members about, you know, how do you, you know, I guess it's one thing to have that, you know, that annual review, or even to think about it once a month, how am I going to get, you know, whoever it is, Tracy, to continue to feel like she's growing. How do you do that on a conversational basis? Is there something that you do to remind yourself where that person's going?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, listening for potential is a skill everyone uses from time to time, and we all have the muscle. When I've trained thousands of people in this. You know, when you teach people to do it, they get it pretty quickly. They go, "Oh, I know how to do this. I did this with my kids," you know, or "I did this with a friend." You know, I believed in this person, and I wanted them to win. And that's kind of what it's about, you know, believing in someone and wanting them to win. And I think, you know, the question I ask myself when I'm having a conversation with someone, you know, do I believe this person? Do I want them to win? If the answer is no, then I need a different type of conversation, right? If I don't believe in this person or I don't want them to win, then I better sort that out, because that's going to come out unconsciously in my language and we're going to have a problem. So, so believe in people and, you know, want them to win, and you'll see, you know, the conversation starts to flow better.
A surprising recommendation you make for becoming a better listener is avoiding getting lost in the details. So in other words, if you want to be an effective listener, you really need to keep thinking about things on a high level. Why is that so important?
The trouble is that our ability to process information is actually very limited. And at any one time, we can only hold a certain amount of information and process it. You can't multiply four digits in your head unless you're a savant. And there's not many steps and not much data in that. It's a very small, on paper, it's really easy. But trying to do it in your head, it's very hard. Mm-hmm. And so to actually think through things, we've got to simplify them. And the trouble is if our mind is filled with details, we can't then notice patterns, right? And if we want to notice patterns, if we want to know if project is making money or losing money, we can't fill our brains with the details of 100 clients. We have to actually pull back from the details and just look at, a page of numbers, right? We just literally can't go there. So in order to maximize this limited resource, we often have to minimize the detail and be focusing more on the patterns above those details, and find insight in there. I think that's the simplest way to describe it.
Can you remain a good listener if you're ignoring part of the story?
Well, it's not about ignoring the details. It's about dipping into the details that you need. But I find employees often start with the details and assume that we need to know everything. And usually we don't. Usually as a manager or leader, what we need to know is it on track? If not, how off track is it? Are you confident in what you need to do next? Are we clear on if this is the right strategy? And, can we make this work? These kinds of questions. And in some ways, being out of the detail helps you to, see if these things are true or not. So it's not avoiding the detail. It's just that the manager can't get into the detail if they're going to answer questions like the ones that I just focus on.
Mm-hmm. You offer some counterintuitive advice about delivering feedback. So a lot of times managers are trained to use the feedback sandwich, which is say something nice, then give the negative feedback, and then say something nice again. But you say that doesn't work. So I wonder if you could tell us why that doesn't work and what we should be doing instead.
It works for very low-level things. It works for very low-level things that people don't take personally, which is, almost nothing. So we take everything very personally, especially feedback from a superior. But, really low-level things, how someone is, organizing their space or, just if they're unlikely to take it personally, it might work. But generally what happens when you give feedback is people take it very, very personally. There's a strong reaction, and that reaction really gets in the way of the conversation. And so, a lot of the time, ask a question about the person's own perspective on the way forward rather than, tell. And we find that about 100% of the time, people assume that they need to give feedback. And actually about 75% of the time, you don't need to give feedback. You can ask people what their thoughts are about, their own change, and they'll be right and probably more right than you. Mm. So about 3/4 of the time that you might go to give feedback, you can actually say, hey, what are some things that you're trying to improve here? Are you working on getting better here? What are some of the things that you're mulling over? And people will tell you, and it's actually really fast and, much less stressful. Now, of course, if you've got technical information, if it's a technical task and they're doing something wrong, and, then tell them, if they need a password, tell them, but just, being nice and then telling them I think it actually wastes a huge amount of time and everyone's energy.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I also think that, phrasing it as a question opens it up as a dialogue as opposed to an accusatory criticism. And also people are a lot more willing to be accepting of their own criticism than of other people's criticism. But let me ask you this. I mean, I think there is some pretty powerful research showing that competence predicts your own evaluation of your own competence. In other words, if you feel like if you're not very high on competence, chances are you're going to overestimate how competent you yourself are. So what do you do in those cases where you have someone who you go to, you ask for their own evaluation of how they're doing, and it's completely off track?
The path of convincing people that they're wrong is a very onerous, difficult path. Mm-hmm. And everyone's always looking for tips on how do I convince this person to agree that they're broken. And it doesn't work so well. It doesn't end up, it doesn't end well for just about anyone. So rather than the path of how do I convince this person that they're broken, I would say, how do I help this person change roles, or how do I help this person out of the business, or how do I help this person develop new areas that they will have skills in? So it's developing something new, growing something rather than trying to attack would be the way through.
Great. Well, David, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your insights.
You're welcome. Good to connect, and I hope this has been useful for everyone.